national news.
Good evening and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Vincent McCorry is sitting in for Shaka Sali. Today we take a look at the elections in Ghana.
Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, on the basis of the foregoing election results and by the power vested in me as the chairperson of the Electoral Commission of Ghana and the returning officer of the presidential election, it is my duty and honor to declare Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo as President-elect of the Republic of Ghana. May God bless our homeland, Ghana, and make our nation great and strong. Let peace reign.
Well, after a tightly contested election that took place on Monday, incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party wins a second term in office, beating John Mahama of the National Democratic Congress Party with 51.59% of the vote.
Ghanaians have been partying through the night, celebrating a hard-fought second term in office for President Nana Akufo-Addo. The Election Commission said on Wednesday that the incumbent had won Monday's vote, with nearly 52%, fending off a challenge from old rival John Mahama, who secured over 47%. Addressing his supporters, Akufo-Addo said he would now turn his attention to the economy.
My immediate task will be to continue with the process of reversing the effects COVID-19 has had on our economy and on our lives.
His promise is $17 billion program to boost growth after the pandemic hit the price of oil and cocoa exports. That caused one of West Africa's largest economies to suffer its first quarterly contraction in nearly 40 years. But he will also be under pressure to rein government spending. The debt-to-GDP ratio is now above 70%, prompting warnings from the International Monetary Fund. In his speech, Akufo-Addo also acknowledged the tight race and said it was a sign that Ghanaians want his ruling NPP party and Mahama's NDC to work together.
Now is the time for each and every one of us, irrespective of our political affiliation, to unite, join hands, stand shoulder to shoulder, and work hard to place Ghana where she deserves to be.
Mahama's party has, however, rejected the results, calling the election flawed and discredited. Police have reported more than 60 incidents of violence since the morning of the election, resulting in 5 deaths.
A few days after the announcement of the election results, the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, is calling for an independent forensic investigation into the elections. Former President John Dramani Mahama says the conclusion of the inquiry will determine the opposition party's next move. In an exclusive VOA interview with Peter Clotty, Mahama says the Electoral Commission must learn from the errors it committed to ensure they are never repeated in future polls.
But I think that the incompetence the EC has shown, you know, it will be useful for us to do a forensic audit of the EC's own systems and the numbers to come to what the final number for the EC is. Because as of now, I don't know what number they're going to gazette.
But Mr. President, what is your reaction to the African Union poll observer mission that came out saying that the elections were transparent and credible and that most people were not prevented from voting? The ECOWAS poll observer mission led by Madame Johnson Sirleaf said the same thing, that it was peaceful and transparent. So what do you say to these prominent African organizations that monitored the poll, pretty much giving a stamp of approval to the elections?
Normally, when you have an observer mission like that, you need to wait and see their final report, because often they give the report up to the point of counting. And it's true. I mean, the whole day was peaceful. People went about, you know, voting without any problems. and the queues were orderly. And so they'll say all that. And there were a few instances of people caught with pre-printed ballot sheets. I mean, the video evidence is there. Normally, their final report will capture the collation process. And so this report does not capture the collation process. And a lot went wrong with the collation process.
With me to discuss the results of the elections in Ghana are Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Nightline Africa, who is in Accra, the capital of Ghana, covering the elections. Also from Accra, we're joined by political analyst Clara Berry Kasati. And from Washington, D.C., we're joined by Kwaku Nwoma, professor of international politics at American University. And he is a Ghanaian citizen. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. I want to start with you, Peter. You've been covering this process from Accra for us, from Ghana. And we see after the results, some are jubilating, but not everybody's happy. So up to this point, what's going on? How has been the reaction from the citizens?
Well, it has been quiet. When the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, Attorney Jean Adukwe Mensah, declared incumbent President Ahmadu Dankwa Akufo-Addo as duly elected, his supporters from the New Patriotic Party celebrated throughout the night. I went in the streets, spoke with a lot of people. They were very happy. Some of them were extending a hand of friendship, calling on the losing side, former President John Dramani Mahama, to join and concede defeat, as they said. However, supporters of the main opposition National Democratic Congress are unhappy because their leaders have been holding a series of news conferences complaining about what they described as rigged election. They said some of the numbers did not add up.
If we go to Ghana, Clara, I wanted to ask you this. Just before the elections, we actually witnessed pockets of violence across the country. Supporters of incumbent Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo's party, New Patriotic Party, and also those of John Dramani Mahama, clashed. People died. What really triggered this way before even the election took place?
The clash between political opponents is not new in Ghana, in the sense that since independence, I think right after independence, elections have generally in Ghana been very heavily, quite keenly contested, and occasionally or sometimes we do have pockets of confrontation between political opponents and all of that. Of course, we're disappointed. The expectation was that given where we have reached in our democratic journey, we didn't expect in 2020 we would still have some of the clashes. But yes, there were isolated cases of violence or clashes between the supporters of the two political parties. But to a very large extent, these were isolated incidents in that they were not widespread violence, and they occurred at places that are usually known to be hotspots during election hours because of the tendency for political opponents or supporters of the major political parties to engage in some form of violence. But to a very large extent, this is reducing.
Mm-hmm. Professor Nwoma, this, as Clara mentions, has been witnessed before, you know, these tensions, these clashes, and we saw that this time around there were even accusations of disenfranchisement of fellow citizens. Sometimes there were accusations that the ruling party was messing up with the election voter verification process. What does this tell us about the system? Was the country properly prepared? Was the Electoral Commission properly prepared in order to remove any issues, to do away with any issues that could cause this kind of tensions during the process?
Well, thanks for the question. What it tells us is that the system is not perfect, but it seems to be working. We've always had these problems. It's how they are managed by the leaders of the political parties that determines whether we're going to see further escalation or not. The EC itself has, there's a lot of confidence in the EC, the way it's done its work. There's been questions here and there, but generally they've performed very well under a lot of pressure. And I think that we have to distinguish between the political arguments that are being made and the legal arguments that will follow. If there's proof that there's been some kind of shenanigans going on, going to court and providing evidence to support that is a little different than going to a rally and making claims that may or may not be true. I think the political parties do themselves a huge disservice when they build up expectations and they go out and they tell their supporters that this is an election that has been won, even though the results has not been called yet. They create this crisis of expectation, which usually leads to violence when the results come out and it doesn't match what we expect. But in terms of the security aspects of managing elections, the institutions are there. They are not as strong as we would like them to be, but generally they performed well. And if you look at pre-election surveys that came out, I can refer to the CDD survey, for example, done in October, that people generally have confidence in the EC. And I think that they've discharged their duties very well. We see that the playing field was quite level because look at how much seats the opposition has won in parliament. It's hard to do that in a badly run election. And so we need to look at the whole picture, some of the positive trends. Incumbents that lost, over 100 sitting MPs are now retaining. That's not a system that, a system that's manipulated usually favors the incumbents. A lot of people that thought they had safe seats have been voted out. So there's something bigger going on. I just hope that, understand that there's pain when you lose an election. I just hope that the leaders of the opposition, if they have a case, will encourage their supporters to cool down and wait for their day in court.
And Clara, we know that there were accusations and then counter accusations. For example, in the Eastern Volta region, the NDC stronghold accused the government of voter intimidation there. And this was when security forces were deployed there because of the COVID situation. But in turn, also NPP accused the NDC of attempting to register foreigners in the Borno region, which borders Cote d'Ivoire. So these accusations and counter-accusations, were they very localized, or was this a strategy by both parties so that if you lose, you can always make a claim that it's because of whatever was done before the election?
Generally, the accusations and counter-accusations happen virtually every electoral cycle since the Fourth Republic. Usually, the NDC would make accusations against the NPP in the Ashanti region, and the NPP would make accusations against the NDC in the Volta region, because these are the respective strongholds of the two parties. When it comes to the suspicion, when it comes to the electoral body, it's not new for the electoral cycle. I am not aware that we have ever held elections since the Fourth Republic, and either of the two parties has, after losing an election, has agreed that they lost fairly and squarely each time we have had issues. And I think the reason, to some extent, is not completely unfounded in the sense that because of the way institutionally our constitution provides for the setup of the institutions. If you look at the Ghanaian 1992 constitution, for example, it is the president who appoints virtually everybody else, including those who are the independent institutions. This has usually caused suspicion among the opposition, whoever is opposition member at the time, that there would be collusion between the EC in this case and the ruling party or the party that appointed the election commissioners at the time. So this again is not new. The accusations against the EC are not new. What usually is new is who is doing the accusation. If this one lost, they are the ones to do the accusation, and not the one who appointed the government in power. So going forward, in terms of improvement, I think as a country, if we are really serious about strengthening institutions, we have to go back and take another look at those constitutional provisions with respect to appointment, so that it can foster confidence that whoever occupies the institution at the time is not interested in helping anybody but doing what they are required to do.
Yes. Now, Peter, in the process of, you know, going around and covering the process from before the election on the actual election day, you also spoke to election observers. What did you hear generally in terms of the conduct of the electoral process?
Well, Vincent, election organization and management in Ghana, has its own challenges. However, the Electoral Commission is usually held by an inter-party advisory committee known as IPAC that brings up issues, and then the Electoral Commission officials usually try to address them. And that was the same thing. For the first time, we had the Coalition of Domestic Election Observers, known as CODEO, that worked hand in hand with the Electoral Commission, particularly, organizing this election under COVID-19. And some of the things that usually happen in terms of education, in terms of civic education, let me add that, in terms of political participation in a lot of areas did not happen. Some of these NGOs did not have the funding that they would need to help educate and engage the masses in voter education, among others. And they were telling me when I spoke with officials of CODEO that there were only two major political parties participating in activities across the country. The minor political parties were not present. And so it was only their supporters who benefited with the kind of engagement that they tried to do. And that is why they said that the overwhelming results were for both the ruling or the governing New Patriotic Party and the main opposition, the National Democratic Congress. Now, that is not saying that the minor political parties don't have support, but the groundswell of support for these two major parties are overwhelming, I must add. Now, the Electoral Commission on its own did what it says it wanted to do. Sometimes they are accused of not addressing some of the concerns the political parties present, particularly the main opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, raised a number of issues. The Electoral Commission officials that I spoke with said they addressed all the issues in the run-up to the election. So sometimes you see the accusations that you spoke about earlier on coming up when sometimes the elections are going to be held. And the losing candidate usually, or the losing party usually, comes up with a plethora of accusations and misgivings about certain things that they think should have been done in a certain way that did not happen, and they cry foul as a result of that. It has happened before. The governing party did the same when they were in opposition. They went to the court. They had a stolen verdict written as a book and all that. So this, Ghanaians are aware of some of these things that happen during the elections.
It's like it's the name of the game. But again, I think the fact that there were so many political parties and candidates is evidence of the vibrance of the Ghanaian democracy. Professor Nuoma, let's now turn to the challenges that the president faces in his second term. We know that he has promised to implement a $17 billion program to boost Ghana's economy. And this is after the coronavirus pandemic really hit the country hard in the sectors of oil and cocoa exports. Now, just give us a sense of your understanding of what this will mean, what it really needs to do, and how we'll prioritize the spending of this money.
Okay, so Ghana was actually not doing too badly before COVID. So if you look at all the projections from the World Bank, the economy was healthy, and then COVID came. And even in spite of that, the president really has gotten credit, I think deservedly so, for how the COVID crisis was managed. But everybody's going to come out of this COVID pandemic with an economic problem that has to be handled. There were promises that were made, and when you make a promise, you write a check. Those checks will be due now that he has a second mandate. And the question is whether he's learned lessons that come from his inability to deliver on some of the promises that were made in the first term. The campaign promise was 4 more years to do more. Now he has that 4 years, and we'll see if he's able to deliver on the promises that were made. Some of the problems are structural, so he's going to have to figure out how to get people back to work. He's going to have to figure out how to get the financial sector working again. It was plagued by all kinds of problems. He's going to have to figure out how to get Ghana's exports going again. The macro infrastructure still needs a lot of work, and he's going to have to deal with that, inflation, all those problems. But he's also going to have to deal with problems that are of a personal and closer nature. So charges of nepotism, for example, and corruption that went uninvestigated because it involved people around him. He's going to have to do a better job on that. I think that there's going to be a honeymoon period that because the COVID has bought him a little bit of a cushion. But after that, I think people are going to be expecting this. And the question is whether he still thinks that he has to deliver on these promises, or he thinks that now that he has won a second term, his work is done and is actually just focusing on legacy. And this, you know, from what I've seen, I think that he understands that this is an invitation to aggressively address the problems and not coast and think that, well, my work is done because I've been reelected and I don't have another election coming. Because people are still suffering in Ghana. And so I hope that he takes this mandate seriously and he addresses the problems in a way that shows seriousness and a dedication to the task ahead.
Yes. Now, Claro, we know that he did actually get some credit for trying to help people, cushion them against the impact of the pandemic economically. He even gave some subsidies in the area of electricity. But at the same time, the International Monetary Fund is warning that Ghana is in trouble. It's in trouble because of government spending that has pushed the debt-to-GDP ratio past 70%, which puts the country in jeopardy. How does this work when at the same time the president is saying he's going to implement a $17 billion program?
That's that we wait to see, because like Professor Nyama talked about, a lot of freebies are given all to cushion some kind of relief to cushion the citizens of Ghana. And we know that we are not exactly doing very well financially. So all of these are coming back to the economy to hurt us the next year, from 2021 going, particularly also because of promises of more free education, particularly towards the university, whether that will be rolled out or not. But invariably, like many African countries, I've always said, of what my research reveals, that after the independence, we did very little to change the economic structure of the structure of our economy, so that very largely the structures of our economy are still the way they were during the colonial times, or what the colonial administration left, which is not helping very much, because the colonial setup wasn't made to develop the economy totally. It was made more to exploit the resources of the country rather than empower businesses. So I think going forward, the government has to come back and take another look at the structure of the economy to see how this time you can aim to boost local production. There should be more investment within Ghanaian people to boost food, for example. Food is one of the things that Ghana imports. So we have to go back. I think largely the structure of the economy has to be taken. We have to take another look at it and see what gains we can make and what improvements that we can make.
Yeah, and indeed, you know, for the economy to grow, Ghana needs to look into its resources. This is a rich country. You know, there's some oil, there is cocoa, there are other minerals. And to that effect, the government had promised to revitalize the economy by implementing this program, which they called the National Industrial Revitalization Program, or NRP, and this was meant to revive the private sector growth and stimulate the broader industrialization. Now, Peter, You may not have focused too much on that, but have you heard of this? Are people aware of this revitalization program? Is there any evidence that this thing is there and it's working?
Well, a lot of the supporters that I spoke with, including the campaign chairman, is are of the view that the mandate has been given to Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo and that he is going to jumpstart the economy with this program to create more jobs for the youth. And they said the free senior high school policy is meant to usher in skilled or secondary school students who will be trained. And if they are unable to further their education to the tertiary institutions, they will be able to be trained for some of these jobs. Now, those who have graduated from university, they have a similar program to employ them, including nurses and teachers and all that. But it remains to be seen if the actualization will happen in the first, second, or third year. It remains to be seen if the president will be able to carry out or keep his promises of jumpstarting the economy with this program to help resolve some of the high unemployment among the country's youth.
And now, talking about the country's youth, Professor Nuamand, you're a teacher. It has been said also that Ghana's problem is the education system does not prepare the young people for the workplace. How does Ghana, in that process of revitalizing the economy by kind of building up other industries besides even the oil production area, how does it tailor the education to the workplace, a modern workplace, to transform Ghana into a powerful economy in that region?
Only Ghana. Basically, our educational system is one that favors the Enlightenment-based liberal education model that came with colonialism. I don't want to put all of the problems there, because Ghana's educational system has been diversified greatly in the last 20 years or so, where there are so many different universities and so many different avenues for skill training that if you really wanted to, you could find something to do that will prepare you for the market. And I don't want to dismiss liberal arts and liberal education, which usually people attack, because basically it's how we learn the science of thinking. Now, what you do with that after you've graduated is a different story, and there should be other opportunities. You need an entire ecosystem that allows people to take the skills that they learn in school and to turn them into productive activities. And that's what's missing in the Ghanaian system. We don't have a value chain that produces opportunities for jobs, for people to get entrepreneurial training, to get on-the-job skill training, those kinds of opportunities, internships, or even if you wanted to start a business, money to start a business, the seed capital. There's all this stuff. You need to have these things in play before people can actually fully utilize the education that they get in school. So take people that go to technical schools and learn engineering at a place like Kwame Nkrumah University, for example. They come out, they can do things, but they are not the jobs that they need are not there in the system. So you need an entire ecosystem that facilitates those kinds of transitions that creates opportunities. But the core educational system, I think it works well. You need to add things to it. You need to create opportunities. You have young people out there. They need opportunities to acquire other skills even after they leave school. Maybe there's the need for some kind of curriculum reform. The government has promised some of that. Maybe you need to change pedagogy, the way things are taught. That's always something that you can always do. You can always improve. But the reason why there's unemployment in Ghana is not necessarily because of the educational system. It's a whole bunch of other things that need to be in play in order to allow people to get jobs. And the government, quickly, if I can comment on the government's industrialization policy, the One District, One Factory program, for example, is fantastic, except that they are bringing back import substitution industrialization to fix an unemployment problem. Unemployment is much more than that. You need to address the labor force participation factors. You need to figure out why people don't have the skills that you need, and if you need to create more technical schools, provide those. Otherwise, you can have factories and not have people to work in those factories, or not have markets that will buy things that are produced in the factory. So I just hope that this is a conversation that everybody, all stakeholders can participate in. The education system can be improved, but you need to look at the markets. You need to look at the employment market, labor force participation factors, and how to provide opportunities within the system that you have to allow people to, you know, experiment and to train and to innovate and to create jobs, because that's what we need. We need more jobs, and there are a lot of people that can create jobs if they are given the right kind of support.
Yeah. Well, you're watching Straight Talk Africa. We'll be right back, so don't go away.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
While you're watching Straight Talk Africa today, we're talking about the elections in Ghana. My guests are Peter Clotty, host of Viewers Nightline Africa, political analyst Clara Cabe, Eric Kasati, and Kwaku Nwoma, professor of international politics at American University here in Washington. Now, Peter, just briefly, I wanted you to give us a sense of I want to ask Clara this. Clara, there have been, of course, those issues of subsidizing the different industries, trying to inject money in different places in order to create employment. But some other economists will say, no, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't spend money that way. Let those industries that perhaps need to die because they are perhaps not as well-fitted for the modern economy in that particular region, and inject money into those that look like they have the potential for us to grow and help the economy and also create employment for a majority. What's your take on that?
Just briefly, if you permit me to talk about the education system in Ghana. Actually, I'm a lawyer and a lecturer at the University of Ghana. So I would just say about the education system in Ghana, and then I take the question.
Yes.
The education system in Ghana is robust. It's been diversified. Of course, we inherited it from the colonial times, but it has been diversified, and like everyone else, we continuously update skills. We have to change different things. So the educational system is not the problem. I think the problem is more what happens after school. Of course, like everywhere else, we have the academic courses, we have the professional courses, and we have the vocational courses. The problem is more what happens after school. Do we have the industry? Every industry probably needs to give something to its people, depending on the kind of work that they want to do. So the problem more, which I'm tying into the question you asked now, it's not just money to give to people to trade or to do their business. It's more the structure within the economy. I've always said that if you look at the structure of the Ghanaian economy, it is put in such a way that it is extremely difficult for small and medium companies, SMEs, to survive. So it doesn't matter how much money you give them. If we do not take another look at those structures, it is still going to be very hard. Then they may just be able to survive or keep their head above the water, but they may not make it very well as would be common. So rather than giving them cash or money, I would say we take another look at some of the laws and regulations of setting up businesses in our country, some of the regulation of businesses, for example. So it's a structural issue much more than it is. Money. I think if the right stress are right and the banking system is very well, of course, the expectation is that the banking system should be able to finance ideas to enable creative people put those ideas out and thrive. So I would expect us to go back to the structure, the economic structure. We have to take a look at the laws, regulations, how difficult we make it for small businesses, particularly to survive. And then if we are able to give them a system that helps them to grow, then, of course, we are in a much better way to reviving the economy than we just hand out, if we give them handouts. Mm-hmm. Including their
business. Yes. And talking about the small business, Peter, the previous president who lost now, John Dramani Mahama, was associated with power cuts. And to succeed in small businesses, one of the other things people need is electricity. They need power. They need infrastructure, including roads and bridges. In your talking to people moving around this time, how do people feel about their availability of this, their availability of electricity, and also that of infrastructure that facilitates the businesses that they're engaging in, especially the small businesses?
Well, Vincent, a lot of people are attesting to the fact that the rate at which power was cut in the few years ago, it's not at us at the moment. Now, this is because there's an argument between the two main parties. John Dramani Mahama's party says that we'll resolve this problem of power cut or power rationing or doom so, whichever way you want to call it, before we left power. However, the present government said we are the ones that did it. Now, the accusations have been going back and forth, and the claims have been going back and forth as to who actually solved it. The clear case is that a lot of Ghanaians are enjoying uninterrupted power supply for quite some time now. Businesses that I spoke with, officials who have businesses and market women that I spoke with, are seeing some improvement in the way power is running at the moment. However, the power companies, the distributing power companies, are expressing concern that they are owed $1 billion or so dollars worth of debt that the state has yet to defray. So some time ago, they threatened to cut the power off. I don't know what happened, but it's quiet now. The clear case is that a lot of Ghanaians are enjoying power at the moment. Now, it did not get worse when the president gave them free electricity, free water. However, as Professor Nyoma said, the debt will come and you have to defray the cost. So that is what the government has to resolve at the moment. But so far, so good. It appears that both administrations made efforts to try to resolve some of these problems because it was adversely affecting businesses across the nation. Now things seem to be improving quite a bit.
Yes, Professor Norma, it's inevitable we still have to talk about what the leaders, whoever's been elected like President Akufo-Addo, has to do in all sectors. Now, if you turn to agriculture, for example, Ghana, I think about 60% of Ghanaians are engaged in agriculture. The economy, in as much as there's production of gold and oil, is to a large extent, it is agri-based. But there is evidence that agricultural productivity has been going down a little bit, has weakened, could be because of climate issues, could be because some more rural people are moving to the urban areas. Urbanization is impacting serious agriculture. How do you help inspire the growth of agriculture? How do you maintain people on their farms and make sure that the agricultural sector is vibrant and it can continue powering the economy of the country?
Very good question. So the problem with agriculture is not the fact that a lot of our people are doing agriculture. It's the type of agriculture that we do. It's mostly subsistence agriculture. So people are stuck in a poverty cycle, using small plots of land, doing mixed cropping. They don't make any money. They just feed themselves. And that's not how a country develops. If you want to revitalize the agricultural sector, you need to look deeper. You need to look into things like land tenure reforms, A lot of peasants don't own land in Ghana, and so they cannot use ownership of land as collateral to get in a loan from a bank to scale up their business. You have to give people a chance to go beyond feeding their families. We have to introduce cash crops, not just cocoa. And the government has been doing some of that, so I want to give them credit for that. But we need to let people understand that to be successful in agriculture, you have to go beyond growing food that you can eat. Globalization has brought a lot of challenges, but it's also given us opportunities. People need to take advantage of that market beyond Ghana. Government is going to have to help. We got to think about supply chain management, because if you're growing tomatoes for exports and you are in Bulga, there has to be a system that allows you to ship your stuff safely. That we have to give credit to farmers. But more importantly, I think land ownership is one of the things that we're going to have to look into and figure out a way of providing some type of security for our people. And there's too many Ghanaians in the informal sector. We have to figure out a way of moving people out of that sector. It's about 70 to 80% of our people. The labor force is stuck in the informal sector. And I don't want to say the informal sector is unproductive, but the wages there are extremely low. And the other thing is that they don't pay taxes. I just saw a report from the Commissioner of Revenue, and he's talking about up 2% of people in the informal sector pay taxes. You cannot develop that way. And so we need to figure out how to create incentives for people who are in the informal sector to scale up, and how to get many more people to participate in the more profitable formal sector so the government can tax them. And people need to understand that if they want good things, they have to pay taxes. People go to hospital in Ghana, for example, and they expect things to be free. But when they go see a juju man or they go see a pastor, they don't expect that service to be rendered free of charge. Yeah. So people need to understand that development requires everybody pitching in. It's not just the government. It's all of us.
Yeah, yeah, they did. And those who are in the informal sector also, in as much as they want to pay tax, they should pay taxes. They also want to see that there's some gain. They need to see some benefits from their taxes so that they can succeed in their businesses. Now, Clara, you have experience in law. In terms of, the agriculture sector, just survival generally, what are some of the legal bottlenecks that Ghanaians have to deal with? And what should legislators in the parliament do to make sure that they make it easier for Ghanaians to own land, to own property, and to participate in the economy at whatever level?
When it comes to agriculture, in terms of the law, it's not the problem with ownership is not in the law. The law is pretty straightforward and clear on how land ownership is. It's more the practicality of the way our institutions work. So it's when we come to implementation, that's where the problem is. Now, when it comes to those in agriculture, for example, their biggest problem are the simple issues like roads. So even if they have a big farm, after they get a big harvest, how do they transport their produce from their farms onto a place they can sell? There are no roads. How do they access the roads? Storage facilities. So these are some of the basic issues that farmers have. The credit of the Ghanaian farmer, if you look at the history of that, people really farmed at some point when it was much easier to export. So some of these issues have to do more with the facilities, access to roads, access to water. A lot of them rely on rain. On rain-fed agriculture, some have irrigation facilities, for example. So when it comes to agriculture, we need to concentrate a lot more on providing access to water, for example, so irrigation dams and roads and storage facilities. And then we can also now take a look at our exports to see how we can help farmers to export some of their produce. Of course, it's not just when it comes to export, what about our laws? Because then they also have to look at the laws of the country into which they are exporting and whether or not their produce meets the required standard and all of that. But I think if we tackle the basics, which is I mentioned earlier on, we are on a better foot. And when it comes to tax, be fair to the Ghanaian people, I don't think the Ghanaian people have a problem with paying taxes. It's part of the problem is how difficult you make it for them to pay tax. And then the other issue you mentioned earlier on, which is the ethics of taxation, how they see their tax money being used, or whether they see that they benefit from the taxes they pay. So to a very large extent, I see the Ghanaian people as people who are willing to cooperate. They've always shown, right, even from colonial, they've always had an invested interest in the way the affairs of the country are run. And when it is their turn to do their job, they do it. Yeah. So we should go back and look at how we can give them the right facilities and aid them in the right legislation. To a very large extent, mm-hmm. on the legislation angle, we are doing really badly. Yeah. We have some of the most beautiful laws anywhere in the world. Our biggest problem is implementation.
Thank you. And those are some very common problems across Africa, in fact. Peter, you know, Clara has mentioned, of course, the issue of infrastructure, especially in the countryside. You've covered Ghana quite a bit. When it comes to the issues of implementing projects that, give people the necessary infrastructure they need in order to prosper, question is, do you see these issues? Did you see them as part of what the electorate wanted to hear from those who are seeking office? Were they seriously discussing these issues, or were they caught up in the high kind of minded kind of thoughts about the economy and 17 billion program and revitalization, but never really took these leaders into task over this very mundane but very, very necessary things of life?
Well, Vincent, let me answer it this way. There have been instances of two parliamentarians or two constituencies in this country, Lejekuku constituency and Adenta here in Accra. Now, these constituencies have kicked out their parliamentarians every 4 years. They demand accountability. When you tell them that you are going to do something, you better do it, else they will kick you out. Now, the Adenta constituency, the man they kicked out was the communications director for the ruling New Patriotic Party. Now, the other one who was kicked out from Lejekuku is Dr. Okoboy, who is a medical doctor, but he is the deputy information minister. Now, Ghanaians are now demanding that if you make promises, you better keep them. Now, when I went around talking to people yesterday, they said the free senior high school education that the president promised before coming to power and implemented was one of the key reasons why they gave him the mandate for an additional 4 years to do more. Now, so they are pretty much holding the feet of these politicians to the fire, that you don't come to make grandiose claims and promises if you don't have what it takes to implement them. You better be serious, because they are aware. I remember in 1992, after Ghana decided to re-embrace the constitutional rule, because of the charm offensive of then the man who has been in power for 10 years at the time, Jerry John Rawlings, who just passed away, he was attractive enough, he won. But then President Kufuor, at that time, an opposition leader, was very strategic in the promises that he made. Now, I spoke with him a few days ago, and he was talking about the strategy that he had to implement because things were not working. The police did not have the things they need to enforce the law. The borders were porous. People were smuggling things everywhere. The city had crashed. So they had to develop a strategy to revive the economy, to focus on partnering with businesses to encourage them to flourish and to create the necessary environment for them to flourish. So some of these issues, when you go around talking to people, they will tell you how comfortable they were with President Kufuor, and that is why they gave him a second 4-year mandate to carry out or finish what he had started. Now, they have done a similar thing to President-elect Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo. It remains to be seen if the promises he made to do more to transform the lives of people, to create jobs for the youth, will materialize. Ghanaians, as I went in the street last night and since I have been here, they are saying, if you make a promise, you better keep it, else they will kick you out.
Well, and that is really how things are supposed to be, because the citizens, the voters, are the employers of these politicians. Professor Nwoma, for a country like Ghana and any other African country, really, to develop, to have good governance, would it be because of goodwill of the leaders or institutions, or the enlightenment of the masses that would, as we, as Peter just said, put the feet of the leaders into the fire to make sure they perform? What will it be?
I would say all of that, Beth, with a caveat. Politicians don't do good on a morality basis. So you got to give them an incentive to do the right thing. But a little bit of political will goes a long way. If the leaders really, really, really care about change, as they do about winning power, we can start making progress. But the people have to hold leaders accountable. And I'm very happy that Peter was talking about the ministers and the big people that lost elections. In this election, this vote, 6 sitting ministers were voted out. 14 deputy ministers were also voted out. So for the first time, we're seeing Ghanaians are saying to people, it's not good enough that you are a minister. You have to show us the results. We want to see the receipts of the work. In the past, it was okay. You could win an election simply because you were a big man and people were happy to be from the same town as the big man. It's not enough anymore. But people have to understand that governments will not do what they need to do unless they hold them accountable. That means that occasionally you have to vote against a party that you voted for your whole life. I'm from Kibi, the hometown of the president. And I talk to my cousins, my relatives all the time. They are not happy with a whole lot of stuff. And I ask them, are you willing to consider voting against him? Are you willing to vote for the other party to send a message? And nobody, people are like, no, I can't see myself doing that. If you can't see yourself doing that, the politicians will take you for granted and they won't do anything. You have to be willing to withhold your support when they don't do what they said they're going to do. And then they have to earn your trust. And I think that once they learn that, because these are smart guys, if they know that the way they win power is by delivering services and is not good enough to just villainize the other party, they're going to deliver. I want to see them try. I'm not saying that it's going to solve all problems, but I want to see the effort. I haven't seen seriousness in Ghana in a long time. I haven't seen new thinking, new energy behind this stuff. It's as if we get satisfied because foreigners are praising us everywhere you go. Ghana is prospering. Ghana's democracy is this. People are poor in Ghana. People are poor. People are dying after this election. Why should you die? Simply because you want to vote. And so that fake praise goes into the heads of our people, and they point to statistics generated by outsiders who don't have to live in a country where there is no water, where people can get jobs, and people have to pay, you know, high costs for bad health care. Then people don't live in these places. So the people that live there that know what's happening, they need to hold governments accountable. And governments have to listen. But if you don't hold them accountable, you're probably not going to get anything from them.
And you know, some of the praise comes in relative terms, right? Comparing Ghana to the neighboring countries and how they performed, especially around election time. Clara, in fact, do you see the danger of complacency, the danger of maybe setting the bar very low just because some of the neighbors are even in more chaotic situation than you are? Is that possibly a problem in Ghana?
It's a problem just for the political elite. To a very large extent, Ghanaians are not that complacent. Yes, we hear that, but like Professor Nwoma wrote it, a large section of Ghanaians see it as fake praise because they also see the problems that they have with day in and day out. So Ghanaians in themselves are not complacent, and to a very large extent, what the particular election has shown is that Ghanaian voter is gradually rising up to holding their various political parties accountable in terms of what they do. To a very large extent, of course, tracing from our country and then tying up generally to other African countries. Politics was not so much the link from identity, which then meant that some people voted for their political party, whether or not, they just felt they owe an obligation to keep a certain political party in power based more on identity and praising more to history rather than what the party is delivering. But we are seeing now, gradually, parties are being held, even being asked for their identities. So people are now moving away from that trend and starting to hold their political parties accountable with respect to voting, at least. Which is a good sign, which, yes, there were allegations, I'm sure you would have heard of vote by, but in many instances, it is not, the money did not influence some of the voters. So you can see that voters are moving away mm-hmm. and gradually exercising the power that they have when it comes to voting. The next thing that we have to look at how them is before the election. So after the election, how do we still keep, how do we still hold our leaders accountable even before election time? And that is where we have a lot more work to do.
Yes.
And to do that effectively, I keep saying we have to go back to our constitution.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, you know, you and I have interacted with so many politicians. We know that during the campaign time, they go down to the villages, to their neighborhoods, the slums, and whatever, to beg for the votes. After they have been elected, they become the big man who are not approachable, not reachable. Question is, have you, in your observation lately, seen that Ghanaian politicians, elected officials, are realizing that they're actually servants of the people and not masters of the people, not big men, but servants?
Well, Vincent, you are right by that. People that I spoke with were telling me the ministers and deputy ministers losing their parliamentary seats sent a very strong signal to these politicians that you either come back to listen to us, to address some of the concerns we have, to have development in their area, else we kick you out. I mean, it was a common refrain among a lot of people, including supporters of the ruling party. So it's not only that some of the opposition, you know, supporters are crying foul, but even the ruling party supporters are saying that, look, now we don't care. If you don't bring development to our area, why should we keep you in office? The other thing, too, is that they think that if the president and the parliamentarian representing them come from the same party, perhaps they could be able to lobby development to come to their area. However, this was not a reflection of what happened just a few days ago. They're saying if you are a parliamentarian, they give you what you call a development fund from parliament to help you, you know, create some form of project in your area. Sometimes the parliamentarians mm-hmm. are able to lobby some big project to come to their constituencies. Yeah. Like, for example, in the Ododo-Diodo constituency, they had the market there being renovated and being rebuilt. You had a boxing arena. You know, the people there like boxing, so they had a boxing arena. And then you have a lot of development. Others are not enjoying that. So either show up or show out.
Exactly. In about 30 seconds, Professor Nuoma, what do you see happening now in Ghana in the next few years as Ghana moves on in this trajectory of, you know, a very celebrated democracy?
I think the president said, give me 4 more years to do more for you. I think Ghanaians should take him at his word and demand that he does more for them. If not, then his party is probably going to pay the price in the next election. And I like the fact that Ghanaians are beginning to take that responsibility seriously. For the opposition has made significant gains in parliament. I hope that they turn that into an invitation to participate in the serious governance business that has to be done.
All right.
Because they are auditioning for the presidency next time.
Thank you. You have the last word there. And on that note, I want to thank Peter Klote, Clara Berry Kasati, and Kwaku Nuoma for joining me on Straight Talk Africa. Have a good evening.